Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, April 5th, 2024. A 4.8 magnitude earthquake centered in New Jersey, about 45 miles from New York City, rattles homes and buildings and nerves. No major damage or injuries reported. White House says President Biden has been briefed and spoke to New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. We will hear from New York Governor Kathy Hochul. President Joe Biden travels to Baltimore to survey the recovery efforts from the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which was rammed by a container ship 10 days ago, blocking the harbor. He said, folks, we're going to move heaven and earth to rebuild this bridge as rapidly as humanly possible. And a group of U.S. House conservative Republicans, known as the Freedom Caucus, puts out a statement listing conditions they want placed on full federal funding that the president is asking for to rebuild that bridge. The March jobs report beats expectations, 303,000 jobs created. The unemployment rate is down to 3.8%. Israel releases a report on the airstrikes that killed seven World Central Kitchen workers in Gaza earlier this week, saying the strikes were carried out in serious violation of the military's procedures and were a grave mistake stemming from a serious failure due to a mistaken identification of vehicles thought to be carrying Hamas fighters. Israel also says it will open new aid routes into Gaza. We'll hear from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, members of Congress of both parties, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Governor Eric Holcomb, Republican of Indiana, talks about U.S. economic relations with Japan ahead of next week's state visit by the Japanese Prime Minister. He says his state and Japan have a long history of economic ties. And a preview of next week's Senate impeachment trial for Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas with Zach Cohen, Bloomberg Government Congress reporter. Story from USA Today, a 4.8 magnitude earthquake recorded in New Jersey shook residents in surrounding states and New York City on Friday morning. The trembler was reported about 5 miles north of White House Station, New Jersey, at about 10:23 a.m. Friday, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. The epicenter was about 45 miles from New York City, where residents reported shaking furniture and floors. No major disruptions or damage have been reported in New Jersey or New York. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said, we have activated our state emergency operations center. Please do not call 911 unless you have an actual emergency. That was from USA Today. New York Governor Kathy Hochul gave an update around noon Eastern at a news conference.
Been in communication with the White House. They reached out to us. The Deputy of Homeland Security Advisor, who's actually with President Biden right now surveying the damage in Baltimore, called us, and I believe they felt the effects even in Baltimore. So it's been a very unsettling day, to say the least. But the White House offered any assistance. Senator Schumer reached out, offered any assistance. So right now, it's most important that we have our structural teams out there, our engineering teams, surveying our bridges, our roads, any area there could be a fault line that is not easily detected, to make sure that passengers on our rails as well as our commuters are safe. Assessing all state roads, Commissioner Dominguez is taking lead on that, making sure our state roads are safe. Major transmission lines and dams, because you don't always see the effects of a small crack that actually could develop into a real major problem. And we're also encouraging all the municipalities throughout the state of New York to assess for any structural integrity concerns. At this point, heading into an hour and a half after the effects, we've not identified any life-threatening situations, but we are certainly asking our local law enforcement and emergency services teams to be on guard for that as well. But again, we are going to be reviewing all potentially vulnerable infrastructure sites throughout the state of New York that is critically important in the aftermath of an event like this.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul at a news conference. The White House putting out a statement. The president spoke with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy about this morning's earthquake. The president said his administration is in touch with state and local officials and will provide assistance if needed. The White House continues to monitor this situation. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, posting on X, I'm closely monitoring the 4.8 magnitude earthquake that was just felt across New York State and the region. Please follow state and local guidance. I urge USGS and FEMA to work together, and I stand ready to mobilize any federal support needed. And Congressman Tom Kaine, Republican of New Jersey, whose district included the epicenter, also on X, it's been confirmed that a 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit New Jersey with the epicenter in Hunterdon County. My team is in close contact with state and local officials as we continue to monitor the situation. We will keep New Jersey 7th Congressional District updated. President Joe Biden traveled to Baltimore today, the site of the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge and the subsequent closure of the port after a container ship hit a bridge pier last week. He and Governor Wes Moore surveyed the damage and recovery efforts by air. And the president met with recovery teams and spoke to family of the six construction workers who died in the accident. The president also made public remarks about reopening the port and his request to have the federal government pay to rebuild the bridge. First, on the port.
First is our priority to reopen the port. This is one of the nation's largest shipping hubs. And it's the top port in America, both in importing and exporting of cars and light trucks, the number one. Simply put, the impact here has a significant impact everywhere, up and down the coast and around the country. Thousands of tons of mangled steel remain lodged in the water, blocking ships from moving in and out of the harbor. I've directed the Coast Guard, the Navy, and the Army Corps of Engineers, who are, by the way, the finest engineers in the world, and the state officials to work together to help remove this steel as quickly as possible and as safely as possible. So far, our team has been able to clear two small channels for essential ships, helping clear the wreckage. And yesterday, the Army Corps announced that by the end of April, they'll be able to open the third channel for some commercial traffic, including car carriers. And by the end of May, we'll open the full channel, My task force on supply chain disruption has been able to be engaging with union, rail, trucking, shipping, state and local leaders to minimize the impact on our supply chains. And I'm proud to announce that the federal government will provide over $8 million in grant funds to make the infrastructure improvements at Sparrows Point as the only port unaffected by this collapse, which will allow Sparrows Point to take on more ships. And that's happening now, will happen shortly.
President Biden at the Baltimore port. The Transportation Department and Baltimore County, Maryland announced an $8.26 million grant which will more than double the port's capacity for cargo vessels carrying cars to and from Sparrows Point, southeast of Baltimore City, according to a White House fact sheet. Labor Department also released $3.5 million in funding from its dislocated workers' grants program to help train or subsidize workers whose jobs were affected by the bridge disaster, as well as assist with other cleanup. President Biden also looked ahead and talked about rebuilding that bridge.
My administration is committed, absolutely committed, to ensuring that the parties responsible for this tragedy pay to repair the damage and be held accountable to the fullest extent the law will allow. But I also want to be clear, we will support Maryland and Baltimore every step of the way to help you rebuild and maintain all the business and commerce that's here now. As the governor can tell you, within hours of the Maryland request, we approved $60 million emergency federal funding. I fully intend, as the governor knows, to have the federal government cover the cost of building this entire bridge, all of it. As we've done in other parts of the country in similar circumstances. While I stand here, I call on Congress to authorize this effort as soon as possible.
President Biden in Baltimore at the site of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said on Thursday it plans to open a narrow shipping channel by the end of this month and could accommodate some large cargo ships. And they hope to reopen the entire shipping channel by the end of May. Shalanda Young, director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, writing in a letter to congressional leaders on Friday, the federal government should cover any needed costs for reconstructing the bridge. While we continue to assess those costs alongside our federal and state partners, we are asking the Congress to join us in demonstrating our commitment to aid in recovery efforts by authorizing a 100% federal cost share for rebuilding the bridge. The U.S. House Freedom Caucus, a group of around 30 House Republicans, put out what it called an official position on bridge funding, and it includes the U.S. should seek maximum liability from the foreign shipping companies involved in the collision and draw all available funds. Any federal funding allocated for the bridge be offset likely with budget cuts, and that all burdensome regulations, their words, such as the Endangered Species Act, are waived. The bill be limited to the physical structure repairs with a federal nexus and not include funding for any unrelated projects. The Biden administration lifted its pause on liquefied natural gas LNG exports before Congress considers appropriating any funding for the bridge reconstruction. That was from the statement put out by the House Freedom Caucus. Two House subcommittees from the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and Homeland Security Committee held a joint hearing today at Port Miami in Florida, looking at safety and security of port infrastructure. Congressman Daniel Webster, Republican of Florida, chair of one of the subcommittees, spoke briefly about the Baltimore Bridge collapse.
Before we begin, I want to mention recent tragedy in the port of Baltimore. First and foremost, our thoughts are with the victims and their families. We greatly appreciate the work of the Coast Guard and other first responders and their heroic efforts in response to this tragedy. As the work gets underway to reopen the channel and rebuild the bridge, carry out an investigation, the Transportation Infrastructure Committee will closely monitor developments and work with the families and stakeholders impacted.
House Subcommittee Chair Daniel Webster at today's hearing in Miami. He then went on to talk about the subject of that hearing.
Cargo activity in the United States ports is crucial to our nation's commerce and accounts for 26% of our nation's GDP, generating nearly $5.4 trillion in total economic activity and supporting 31 million direct and indirect jobs. To protect this crucial economic engine, we need to make the necessary investments and ensure our ports are effectively confront the physical and cyber threats. The Marine Transportation Security Act was passed in the wake of 9/11 and was originally envisioned to guard primarily against physical threats. However, as technology and automation became more ingrained into the port's operation, the risk of cyber attacks grows. For example, we know that from public reporting that one of America's largest ports, the Port of Los Angeles, faces approximately 40 million cyber attacks per month. At the same time, we must also confront the reality of China's influence in the maritime domain, and it's growing, and if left unchecked, threats to overthrow or uprep or disrupt impediments to the maritime transportation sector. Major port equipment, such as terminal cranes, are purchased from China and could present serious vulnerabilities to the supply chain. Loglink, a logistics management system developed by China provides shipment tracking and other logistical services, so while collecting significant amounts of data that could be used for malign purposes or to gain unfair economic advantage.
Congressman Daniel Webster, Republican from Florida, chair of the Subcommittee on the Coast Guard and Maritime Transportation, at today's hearing at Port Miami in Florida. This is Washington Today. From Associated Press, America's employers delivered another outpouring of jobs in March, adding a sizzling 303,000 workers to their payrolls and bolstering hopes that the economy can vanquish inflation without succumbing to a recession in the face of high interest rates. Last month's job growth was up from a revised 270,000 in February and was far above the 200,000 jobs that economists had forecast. By any measure, it amounted to a major burst of hiring, and it reflected the economy's ability to withstand the pressure of high borrowing costs resulting from the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. That was reporting from Associated Press. The acting Labor Secretary, Julie Hsu, was interviewed today on Yahoo Finance.
This is 100% exactly what President Biden's vision for the country is. When we invest in America, especially when we invest in America's workers, build an economy from the middle out and the bottom up, we can see sustained and broad-based growth across the board. So this was a very strong another labor market report that demonstrates stable, steady growth. Not just the 303,000 jobs created, but as you said, the unemployment rate has remained under 4% now for over 2 years. That's the longest stretch since the 1970s. Real wages are up, as you already mentioned, and labor force participation rate remains strong. So it's not just because, this is very much a continued labor market in which people are coming into the labor force, looking for jobs, finding jobs, and getting that piece of, the American dream that we want for every family.
To your point, we learned that the immigration numbers last year were higher than previously thought. How much of that do you think helps explain this strong job growth month after month, while inflation actually hasn't been accelerating? It's been slowly coming down. And we've had a bit of discrepancies also in that household survey.
Exactly. So the prices have been coming down, right, slowly from their peak, another high priority for the president. And I would say that this is an example of how a strong economy overall is just good for everybody. This labor market has pulled in everyone. And so we're seeing certainly growth for immigrants. So that includes immigrants that, we're a nation in which growth has often included the contributions of immigrants. But it's not just for the immigrant community. Just like the sectors in which we've seen growth are broad based, the benefits across different communities have also been really, really broad based. This last month, the growth for labor force participation rate among prime age workers remained steady, but the overall participation rate went up, and some of that was attributable to more young workers in the labor market.
The acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu interviewed on Yahoo Finance today. Wall Street, the Dow up 303, NASDAQ up 199, S&P up 57. From CBS News, the Israeli military announced Friday that it dismissed two officers and reprimanded three others for their roles in drone strikes in Gaza that killed seven aid workers on a food delivery mission, saying they had mishandled critical information and violated the Army's rules of engagement. An investigation carried out by a retired Israel Defense Forces general into the Monday killings marked an embarrassing admission by Israel, which faces growing accusations from key allies, including the U.S., of not doing enough to protect Gaza civilians from its war with Hamas. The incident should not have occurred, the IDF said in a statement summarizing retired General Yoav Har-Ivan's seven-page findings. Those who approved the strike were convinced that they were targeting armed Hamas operatives and not WCK employees, that's World Central Kitchen. The strike on the aid vehicles is a grave mistake stemming from a serious failure due to mistaken identification, errors in decision-making, and attack contrary to the standard operating procedures. That was reporting from CBS News. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about this to reporters at the airport in Brussels, Belgium, before boarding his plane back to the U.S.
We received Israel's report on the terrible killing of the World Central Kitchen team in Gaza a few days ago. We're reviewing it very carefully. We'll be discussing its conclusions with Israeli officials and with humanitarian organizations in the days to come. It's very important that Israel is taking full responsibility for this incident. It's also important that it appears to be taking steps to hold those responsible accountable. Even more important is making sure that steps are taken going forward to ensure that something like this can never happen again. Prime Minister Netanyahu indicated to President Biden that Israel would be making further changes to its procedures to make sure that those who are providing assistance to people who so desperately need it in Gaza are protected. So we're going to be looking very carefully at what those steps are, how it achieves better deconfliction, better coordination, so that aid workers are protected. At the same time, as Israel pursues any military operations against Hamas, it has to prioritize the protection of civilians. It has to make that job number one. Too many people have been caught in this crossfire of Hamas's making. Children, women, men, losing their lives. Their safety has to be a priority, and military operations need to be designed around their protection, not the other way around. So we'll be looking at all of this in the days to come, and we'll be, as I said, assessing fully the report on the World Central Kitchen incident, and looking to see not just what steps are being taken, but the results that follow from them.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, everyone.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken making that statement at the airport in Brussels. The World Central Kitchen, a U.S.-based food charity, is calling for an independent investigation after Israel killed seven aid workers who were delivering food in central Gaza. The organization said, "We have asked the governments of Australia, Canada, the United States of America, Poland, and the United Kingdom to join us in demanding an independent third-party investigation into these attacks, including whether they were carried out intentionally or otherwise violated international law." U.S. Congressman Steve Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee, posting on X, "Gaza's humanitarian crisis is dire, and the loss of seven World Central Kitchen workers was the last straw. The U.S. must always support Israel's defense, but it's time to consider limiting offensive aid unless there's a solid plan to safeguard civilians, including expanded aid access." Congressman Cohen included a clip of his interview Thursday night on CNN.
"If Netanyahu will not do what the president has asked, which is to have more aid, more humanitarian aid, more, and he's opened up another entry point in the north for, says he will, for humanitarian aid and another port. And I suggested this to Israel two or three months ago, to have more entry points, particularly in the north. And they should have done that. But if they don't do that, and if they don't start to have more careful use of their weaponry, you know, they killed three Israeli hostages who had escaped and were waving white flags, and it one of them had gotten out and retreated after his colleagues were killed, and then he came out speaking Hebrew, and they killed him too. So apparently some of the Israeli soldiers, we've gotten a feeling about the IDF that they're like the folks that won the Six-Day War, and that they're master military people like Moshe Dayan. Well, they're not. And a lot of them are young and have been called into action, and maybe they're not being told to be more careful and more concerned because they're dealing with a group that it just killed 1,200 Israelis, and they're really emotional about it. Netanyahu is not good for Israel right now. He's a pariah in many parts of the world, and he's hurting Israel, and he's hurt politically a lot of people who have supported him for years, including President Biden. They said that one of the problems here was that it was at night, and if they have a problem at night where they can't identify the vehicles, then they shouldn't be shooting at night. If that's such a problem, don't be shooting at night, because it's obviously they're not capable of discerning friend from foe. Hamas needs to be eliminated, but Israel needs to be very cautious about how they're using their offensive military tactics so that innocent civilians. Every time I see a child who's lost a leg or been killed, it's just horrific. It brings trauma to you and tears to your eyes and your heart. And we need to stop that. And when he Jose Andreas is one of the kind of, he's an angel himself. He referred to his workers as angel. He's an angel going into these areas all over the world trying to help people in need. And for Israel to have not been capable of getting the information from them, which they gave, those cars being on a certain road and what kind of cars they were, not protecting them and giving all possible precautions, that just, it's unexcusable. And the fault goes to the top. And when you're at the top, you need to accept responsibility. And I don't think Netanyahu's ever accepted responsibility for anything.
Congressman Steve Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee, on CNN Thursday night. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has posted a video it produced with this caption: "A delegation of 16 House Republicans are currently in Israel with the American-Israel Education Foundation, the charitable organization affiliated with AIPAC. They visited communities in southern Israel that were ravaged by Hamas on October 7th. Here's the video.
Hi, Congressman Rudy Yochum here from Indiana's 2nd District.
Hello, this is Juan Siskomani from Arizona.
I'm Celeste Malloy, Congresswoman for Utah's 2nd Congressional District.
We're at the kibbutz near Oz that was totally devastated by the Hamas attacks on October 7th. They had roughly 25% of the people that were in this kibbutz either killed or kidnapped on that day.
I'm here at the site of the festival. We have seen the names, we have seen the numbers, but once you see the faces and you're here, ground zero, it hits differently.
Being here, hearing firsthand from families about what they've personally gone through, what the aftermath has been.
It was really important to me personally that in a time of war, that we show support to one of our strongest allies.
Our hearts and thoughts and prayers still go out to the people who survived this, and may they all be brought back home.
Israel will continue to have my support as a member of Congress and also as an American.
a video produced and posted by AIPAC featuring some of the U.S. House Republicans visiting Israel. One of the voices you heard did not self-identify, Congressman Russell Fry of South Carolina. From Reuters, the United Nations Human Rights Council on Friday adopted a resolution calling for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip, although Israel dismissed it as a distorted text. 28 countries voted in favor, 13 abstained, and 6 opposed the resolution, including the United States and Germany. The adoption prompted several representatives to the council to cheer and clap. Israel's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva accused the council of having long abandoned the Israeli people and long defended Hamas. That's reporting from Reuters. The United Nations Security Council also met today to discuss the war, because Sunday marks 6 months since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke to reporters outside the Security Council chamber.
The war in Gaza is the deadliest of conflicts for civilians, for aid workers, for journalists, for health workers, and for our own colleagues. Some 196 humanitarian aid workers, including more than 175 members of our own UN staff, have been killed. The vast majority were serving UNRWA, the backbone of all relief efforts in Gaza. Others include colleagues from the World Health Organization and World Food Program, as well as humanitarians from Doctors Without Borders, the Red Crescent, and just a few days ago, World Central Kitchen. An information war has added to the trauma, obscuring facts and shifting blame. Denying international journalists entry into Gaza is allowing disinformation and false narratives to flourish. We honor all humanitarian workers who have been killed in this conflict and pledge to remember their commitment and sacrifice. Following this week's appalling killing of 7 humanitarian workers from World Central Kitchen, the Israeli government has acknowledged mistakes and announced some disciplinary measures. But the essential problem is not who made the mistakes. It is the military strategy and procedures in place that allow for those mistakes to multiply time and time again. Fixing those failures requires independent investigations and meaningful and measurable changes on the ground. In the aftermath of this tragedy, the United Nations was also informed by the Israeli government of its intention to allow a substantial increase in humanitarian aid distributed in Gaza. I sincerely hope that these announced intentions are effectively and quickly materialized, because the situation in Gaza is absolutely desperate. Dramatic humanitarian conditions require a quantum leap in the delivery of life-saving aid, a true paradigm shift. I repeat my urgent appeals for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, the protection of civilians, and the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres meeting with reporters today at the UN in New York City. New York Times has an article. The CIA Director William J. Burns is expected to travel to Cairo this weekend for further talks on releasing Israeli hostages being held in Gaza, according to two people briefed on the plans. American officials believe negotiating a pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas and the exchange of Israeli hostages held in Gaza for Palestinian prisoners held in Israel is the only way to put a temporary ceasefire into effect and increase the flow of humanitarian aid into the enclave. That was from the New York Times. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. From CNN, President Joe Biden will host Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Fumio at the White House next week for an official visit to the United States, which will include a joint news conference and a state dinner. Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden will welcome Kishida and his wife, Kishida Yuko, to Washington on April 8th for a meeting. The news conference will take place April 10th, followed by the state dinner. The visit and state dinner, the fifth Biden has hosted as president, emphasize the importance of the alliance between the United States and Japan as both countries seek to counterbalance China's influence. That was reporting by CNN. Indiana's Republican Governor Eric Holcomb previewed the visit today at an event hosted by the Hudson Institute. The governor's office says that Indiana is home to more than 1,050 foreign-owned business establishments, including more than 300 from Japan, that employ more than 55,000 Hoosier jobs. And among all U.S. states, Indiana has the largest amount of Japanese investment per capita. Here is Governor Holcomb.
Our goal is to make sure that we're sticky and they stay in Indiana. And you can see it not just in our school settings, but in our decades-long people-to-people relationships or our sister state relationship with Tochigi Prefecture, in our 13 now sister city relationships that Indiana communities all over our state really do hold dear, that are built into their community cultures. You can see it in our global partnerships with the Japanese government, Aichi Prefecture and Gunma Prefecture, and you can see it, of course, in our five Japanese language Saturday schools and in the continuous educational exchanges between Indiana and, again, Japanese universities. You can see it throughout the communities where Japanese investments took hold and in our co-commitment to advancing quality of life and quality of place initiatives. And the opportunity for our residents, Toyota, for example, has invested millions of dollars back into Hoosier communities in their region that are funding youth development initiatives in southern Indiana, down in Gibson County, Princeton, Indiana. That's just one example, like at the YMCA and coming together in terms of place-making initiatives, housing, et cetera, to be part of, again, the collaboration and the partnership to improve and raise up that quality of life for their teammates, but also for people who don't work at Toyota, as an example. And you can also, of course, see it in our commitment from a state perspective, from our Indiana Economic Development Corporation's perspective. We have a branch office in Japan for the last 40 years, and it's, you know, busier today than ever, which is obviously no surprise. As you've picked up, we're on a roll here, and there's a lot of momentum. So it's natural that our long, close friend is helping drive that good and busy schedule. And you can see it because we've created such a solid foundation for these relationships over that last 40 years.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, a Republican, at today's Hudson Institute program. New York Times article with the headline, "With no labels out of the 24 race, the third-party picture comes into focus." He's talking about the centrist group No Labels, which announced Thursday that it cannot find a candidate to run for president and so will end that effort. He writes of the candidates still in it. The leading figure among this group is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the political scion with a well-funded super PAC, and a running mate with access to a Silicon Valley fortune. Mr. Kennedy running as an independent, polls in the mid-teens when he's included in surveys, but it will be months before it's clear whether he can even make the ballot in enough states to make an impact on the general election. The other well-known independent candidate, the celebrity professor Cornel West, has done little to indicate that he's even trying to make the ballot. Campaign finance reports show he is not raising significant funds, nor is he funding a program to collect signatures to get on ballots. The Green Party and the Libertarian Party have more mature ballot access programs with long records of getting their candidates onto ballots in most states. Jill Stein, the 2016 Green nominee, is running again. Mr. Kennedy has publicly flirted with Libertarians, though the evidence so far indicates the attraction is not mutual. That was from the New York Times. C-SPAN interviewed Jill Stein and the chair of the Libertarian National Committee this morning. First, Jill Stein.
So tell us about why you're seeking this third-party bid and what differentiates you from the other candidates.
Well, Americans are really hurting, and they're really hurting for something different. People are really tired of being thrown under the bus by wealthy elites and their bought politicians. People are living paycheck to paycheck. 63% of workers, actually, half of people who rent are financially stressed, just trying to keep a roof over their heads. You have 100 million people in medical debt, 44 million struggling in student debt. So people are really hungry for a change. And what makes me different as a Green Party candidate is that we are not bought and paid for. We actually don't accept corporate PAC money. We don't sanction super PACs, which is how billionaires can pour unlimited amounts of money into the routine political parties and the routine campaigns, that is, from the establishment parties, and basically, you know, call the shots from the insides, because it's the billionaires and the bankers who are basically funding those campaigns and those political parties. So I have the unique ability to meet people's really urgent needs with solutions that are proven, that work, that stop the incredible waste, fraud, and abuse that's built into the system.
Jill Stein, Green Party presidential candidate on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning. Also on this morning's show, Angela McArdle, Libertarian National Committee chair.
And I don't need to tell you that it's a little bit difficult for third-party candidates in this country. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on what you're really trying to accomplish by running a candidate?
Sure. So there are different ideas within the party about what we're trying to accomplish. Some of our members really do want to win the presidency. My perspective, and the perspective of many of our other Libertarian National Committee members, is that the presidential race exists as a platform for our message. We want to get the word out there about libertarianism, about the party, grow the party at the local grassroots level, get people elected locally, help down-ticket candidates, because ballot access is essential as well, and use the Libertarian presidential race as a platform to accomplish all those things. And certainly we want to be excellent messengers for the message of liberty and wake people up to the evils of large federal government.
And you mentioned getting on the ballot. You're on 37 now. Do you expect to get on all 50 states?
I believe we're going to get on 48 to 50 states. Illinois and New York are tricky, but we are actively working out plans right now to make it happen. New York requires 45,000 signatures in 6 weeks. You know, unfortunately, the state of New York kicked us off the ballot after Larry Sharp, a past gubernatorial candidate, got us ballot access. So it is definitely a challenge. It's a very expensive endeavor. It takes a lot of logistical networking, and it all has to happen very quickly. Illinois also requires 35,000 signatures, although thankfully it's not in a shorter period of time. But other than those two, I think we feel pretty comfortable where we're at in our ballot access race right now.
And the finally, before we get to calls, I just want to ask you about your nominating convention. It's happening end of May here in D.C. The theme is becoming ungovernable. What does that mean?
We want people to take their lives into their own hands. We do not like what we've seen come out of Washington, D.C., especially over the last administration. You know, President Biden has made such disparaging comments about American citizens, telling us that if we didn't abide by his medical edicts, that we would experience a severe winter of illness and death one year. He's had such divisive language. It just seems like the federal government wants more and more control over our personal lives. We're really interested in just taking that power back for ourselves. And so we encourage people to become ungovernable.
Angela McCarta, Libertarian National Committee Chair, part of our discussion on this morning's Washington Journal. The Washington Journal is live every morning at 7 Eastern on C-SPAN Radio and Television. And you can find all the programs that air each day, then archived at our video library at cspan.org. Associated Press headline, Americans think a president's power should be checked. AP NORC poll finds, unless their side wins. One of the paragraphs in the article reads, overall, only about 2 in 10 Americans say it would be a good thing for the next president to be able to change policy without waiting on Congress or the courts. But nearly 6 in 10 Republicans say it would be good for future President Donald Trump to take unilateral action, while about 4 in 10 Democrats say the same if Joe Biden is reelected. Story from CBS News, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a New York Democrat, laid out a long list of priorities ahead of lawmakers' return to Washington next week, ranging from Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas' impeachment trial to Ukraine aid and funding for the reconstruction of Baltimore's Key Bridge. In a letter to senators on Friday, Schumer said the upper chamber has a busy agenda to get through in the coming weeks. Congress has been on recess for 2 weeks after finally resolving a government funding feud that put other matters on the back burner. The majority leader stressed that bipartisanship and compromise are the only ways to make progress and get things done. That was reporting by CBS News. C-SPAN spoke to a reporter about what to expect with that impeachment trial.
Zach Cohen is a congressional reporter for Bloomberg Government. He joins us to preview the next steps in the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And Zach, what can we expect to see as things unfold on Wednesday?
So on Wednesday, the House impeachment managers, essentially the House members who are taking the lead on the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, will formally deliver the articles of impeachment from the House to the Senate. This is something that normally happens to kick off a trial of anybody who's impeached in the House and then is sent over to the Senate. And so we expect that to happen on Wednesday, and then senators will be formally sworn in on Thursday as jurors in that trial.
And it's led by the chair of the Homeland Security Committee and also Patty Murray, the senior senator of Washington State. She's playing a role. Tell us who's going to be involved in this process.
That's right. The lead impeachment manager is Mark Green, a Republican from Tennessee. He's the lead impeachment manager because he is the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. And so he's been leading the effort in the House to get Mayorkas impeached for some time now. Over in the Senate, Patty Murray, the Democratic senator from Washington, will preside over the trial in her role as president pro tempore of the Senate, which is normally a job that doesn't get a lot of attention. And viewers might remember from previous impeachment trials of former President Donald Trump that Chief Justice John Roberts from the Supreme Court actually presided over that first trial. And that's actually set out in the Constitution in order to avoid a conflict of interest of the vice president, who would normally preside over the Senate at particularly important junctures, so that the vice president, the number two in government, is not overseeing the trial of the number one in government. But because Mayorkas is obviously not the president, but a cabinet secretary, there's not that conflict of interest. And so the normal presiding officer will oversee that and will sort of kick things off on Thursday.
And you've written that we could see several motions that Democrats will try to use to shorten this process. What options do Democrats have to end this quickly?
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats generally have been pretty hush-hush about exactly what procedural motions they would do in order to dismiss these charges. They could offer a motion to table or dismiss the charges outright, but essentially avoiding an ultimate judgment on the guilt or innocence of Mayorkas on these charges. And so we expect that, you know, both Senate Democrats and Republicans alike have kind of dismissed the arguments that the House made in these impeachment articles, which were passed by the narrowest of margins a couple of weeks ago, and will want to spend very little time on considering them.
What about referring to committee? Is that an option?
They certainly could. That's something that's been done in the past for judges who have been impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. Ultimately, it sort of creates a new venue where senators could go through the evidence and consider it and then bring it back to the full chamber for an ultimate vote on guilt or acquittal. But as we expect this time, they probably won't even go that far and simply dismiss them out of hand. And that would only require a simple majority. Even though the Senate usually requires 60 votes to pass legislation on most key bills, because impeachment is highly privileged in the Senate, it's not subject to a filibuster and therefore only requires a simple majority on some of these more routine motions.
What do you see as some of the possible political ramifications of this impeachment for senators who are up for re-election?
The key senators to watch people are like John Tester of Montana, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, these Democrats who are really tough re-election races, running for re-election in states that Trump carried by a very wide margin in the last presidential election and the one preceding that. And so how they vote will be important to watch. But people like Tester, Brown, Senator Joe Manchin, the centrist Democrat from West Virginia who's retiring, have all dismissed these charges in the past and have said that the Senate really shouldn't spend a lot of time on reviewing these articles of impeachment. Republicans have been eager to talk about Mayorkas and the Biden administration's border policies in general because they think it's an important issue for them in the 2024 election and something that certainly voters will hear about over the coming months. But certainly senators, it seems, have come to the conclusion that voting to simply dismiss these charges at the onset is not going to have any sort of political ramification for them.
Zach Cohen reports on Congress for Bloomberg Government. Thanks for your time.
Sure thing.
The Senate returns from recess Monday, April 8th at 3 p.m. Eastern. The House is back Tuesday, April 9th at noon Eastern. As always, live gavel-gavel coverage on the C-SPAN networks. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.